Welcome back, Hemingbrains, to the Hemingbrain Society. I don't know. I thought I'd try something new. Have I used society before? We are talking about Book 1, Chapter 27. Julian isn't quite fitting in. That was the prompt. Oh man, that's a long comment there by Swim Said the Mum Fishy. With links, and it looks very well thought out. But if I'm honest with you, I did just get off my elliptical machine. I just did a workout, and I'm like dripping sweat all over my desk. And for some reason, when I got off, rather than drinking water, because I was obviously thirsty after having just done a workout, I just drank a bunch of Diet Coke, and that's just dumb. On the list of dumb things you can do, that's on there. Okay, I'm going to read this comment. I'm going to read it. I'm not going to be lazy, and I'm not going to be rude to Swim, who's put so much thought into this comment. I found this thread through the chapter interesting. These young peasants, terrified by hard work and their father's poverty, I have known myself of mountain parishes where the supplemental fees are worth far more than those of parish priests in the city. He saw someone toss a coin in the air, and if the heads or tails was guessed correctly, everyone said that coin tossed would soon have a parish rich of supplemental fees. The French Revolution had pretty much decimated the Roman Catholic Church, but Napoleon brought it back. Napoleon came back to power in 1799. I don't remember any of these quotes. Are you sure this is from the chapter that we just read and not the next chapter? You know, I'm going to read the comments that you made on the quotes, but not the quotes. The French Revolution had pretty much decimated the Roman Catholic churches, but Napoleon brought it back. Writings from his youth shown that Napoleon had little time for religion, but much like his philosophies, he saw its uses for society. He also appreciated its cost-saving benefits, demonstrated by state-sponsored re-establishment of religious congregations and run hospitals and schools. Above all, Napoleon recognized that if relations were mended with the church, it could be used to promote and consolidate his rule throughout France. Ignoring objections from revolutionary opponents of the church, Napoleon set about formalizing its place in France in a way designed to ensure that loyal membership of the church and the state were no longer mutually exclusive. 2 a.m. on 16th of July 1801, France signed with Rome a document known as the Concordat, the product of 8 months of grueling negotiations. Catholicism was henceforth to be recognized only as the religion of the vast majority of French citizens, a description that denied the church any privileged place within the state, and the church was to give up all claims to property lost during the revolution. The Concordat's most dramatic step, however, was to bring the church under the authority of the state. In measures that recalled the civil constitution, all clergy were required to swear an oath of loyalty to the government. Their salaries were to be paid by the state. Dioceses were again redrawn. I don't know what I'm reading. I'm just going to skip this because, honestly, I don't know what I'm reading right now. I don't know if I'm reading a comment that you've written or something you've copy-pasted from Wikipedia or somewhere else. And I don't understand what I'm reading. I don't know what a concordat is. I don't know what organic articles 27 are. I don't know what a diocese is. I don't know what a civil constitution is. I don't know what administrative divisions are. I don't know what Article 1 is. I understand like the words in between the nouns, basically, of your sentences, of this comment, I should say, not typically of your sentences. So, moving along. Sorry, failed by me, but my brain is not functioning enough to even start Googling all the words I don't understand in that slab of text. Laura Weistich said, first, Julian was too much of a peasant. Now he's not enough of a peasant. He doesn't fit in anywhere. There you go. That's the level my brain can comprehend. I understand that sentence. You are dealing with an idiot. Try to bear that in mind. Non-creative handle said, the self-awareness of this chapter was great. It felt like there was no fourth wall. Aside from my enjoyment of the self-awareness of this chapter, I felt bad for Julian because it was almost like he went back to where he started. He's in an environment where he feels he doesn't fit in. And on top of that, he has to be on the defensive with his peers. All right. There is the conversation for this chapter, or at least the bits of it that I can wrap my head around. I can't even remember what the chapter was about. I do remember it being good, though. What was it about? Man, my brain is in another world right now. I do apologize. You know what? I've got to go to schmoop.com and recap the chapter. It was only 4 pages. I literally cannot remember a thing about it. Chapter 27. All right, here's my recap of the chapter. Courtesy of schmoop.com. I shouldn't say mine because it's not mine. There's only 3 dot points for the whole chapter. Julian goes around flashing his knowledge and intelligence so freely that people start to nickname him Martin Luther, after the man who read the Bible very closely and helped create Protestantism as a break-off from Catholicism. In other words, the other students question Julian's loyalty to the true faith of Catholicism. On several occasions, Julian's classmates try to beat him up, but he has a metal tool he uses as a weapon, and he keeps fending them off. There we go. I got all that. I did get all that. Yeah, it's funny that in a Catholic setting, knowing the Bible, knowing the Catholic Bible too well makes you seem Protestant-ish and gets you beaten up. Strange, strange world. Chapter 28 is called A Procession. Every heart was moved. It seemed as though the presence of God had descended into the narrow Gothic streets, which were decorated on each side and well sanded by the cares of the faithful young. Julian had tried his very best to make himself insignificant and dull, but he could not please. He was too different. Yet he said to himself, all these professors are shrewd men picked out of 1,000. How is it they don't appreciate my humility? Only one of them appeared ready to take advantage of his willingness to believe everything and seem to be deceived by everything. This was the Abbe Chasbernard, the director of ceremonies at the cathedral, where for the last 15 years he had been led to expect a canonry. Whilst awaiting this, he taught pulpit oratory at the seminary. During the period of Julian's blindness, this was one of the classes in which he had most habitually excelled. The Abbe Chas had gone out of his way to show him friendship, and when the class came out, would gladly take him by the arm for a few turns around the garden. What is he driving at? Julian would wonder. He felt astonished that Abbe Chas should talk to him for hours at a time about the ornaments possessed by the cathedral. It had 17 gold-laced chasubles, in addition to the mourning vestments. High hopes were being entertained of the ancient President de Aruba Mempre. This lady, who was 90, had preserved her wedding dress, made of superb lion's cloth embroidered in gold, for at least 70 years. Just imagine it, my friend, said Abbe Chas, stopping abruptly and opening his eyes wide. These fabrics have so much gold in them that they stand up on their own. It is widely believed that in Bezicon, under the President's will, the cathedral's treasures will be increased by more than 10 chasubles, not counting 4 or 5 copes for high festivals. I could go further, added the Abbe Chas, lowering his voice. I have my reasons for believing that the President will leave us 8 gorgeous gilded candlesticks, thought to have been bought in Italy by Charles the Bold, Duke of Burgundy, whose favourite minister was an ancestor of hers. Now, what is this person trying to get at with all these old furnishings? Wondered Julian. This clever build-up has been going on for ages, and nothing comes of it. He must be tremendously suspicious of me. He is cleverer than all the others. You can see through to their hidden agendas within a fortnight easily. Oh, I understand. This one's ambition has been on edge for the last 15 years. One evening in the middle of the arms drill, Julian was summoned to the Abbe Pirard, who said to him, tomorrow is the festival of Corpus Christi. Monsieur the Abbe Chasbernard needs your help in decorating the cathedral. Go and obey. Abbe Pirard called him back and added with an air of commiseration, it's up to you whether you wish to make use of this occasion to wander into town. In situ per ignis I have hidden enemies, replied Julian. The next day, as soon as it was fully light, Julian walked to the cathedral with lowered eyes. The look of the streets and the bustle beginning to spread in the town did him good. On all sides, house fronts were draped for the procession. The whole of the period, guys, what you're experiencing now, by the way, is the thing that tends to happen to me with every book so far in the Hemingway list. As it gets more religion-y, you'll just hear me losing interest. And it's not the book's fault. It's completely on me, but I just don't care about, like, religious proceedings, like if you're describing a what is this, a procession, and talking about the clergy, it's all meaningless to me. It's all just pageantry, and I don't know, for me it's dull, and I can't pay attention to it because it's just meaningless, and it goes so deep. It's like layers and layers and layers and layers and traditions and stuff, and it just doesn't compute in my head. So that's me. I'm very kind of apathetic, I suppose, agnostic, you could say. Disinterested is the best word. So I know not everyone is that way. I know a lot of people very interested in religion and the layers and the myths and the symbolism and all that. But yeah, that's just a hazard of the Hemingway List podcast, is I don't know, can't control it. Let us continue. The whole of the period he had spent in the seminary appeared to him no more than an instant. His thoughts dwelt on Virgie and on the attractive Amanda Bennett, whom it was possible he would meet, since her cafe wasn't far away. From far off, he saw the Abe. Okay, now we're talking. He's even disinterested. From far off, he saw the Abe Chaspinard at the door of his beloved cathedral. A portly man with a cheerful face and a candid air, today he was triumphant. "I've been waiting for you, my dear child," he cried as soon as he saw Julian in the distance. "Consider yourself welcome. Today's task will be long and hard, so let's fortify ourselves with the first breakfast. The second will be due at 10 during the High Mass." "I ask, Monsieur," said Julian with a solemn look, "not to be left on my own for an instant. Be so good as to mark," he went on, pointing to the clock above his head, "that I got here at 5:01. Ah, those little devils at the seminary have scared you. You flatter them by paying attention to them," said the Abe Chas. "In the road, the less beautiful, because there are thistles in the hedges at its side. Travellers much ahead, and leave the nasty spikes to rot where they stand. In any case, let's to work, my friend, to work." Abe Chas was right in saying that the job would be hard. The previous evening there would have been grand funeral ceremony in this cathedral. There had not been time to prepare anything, so it was necessary in a single morning to drape all the Gothic columns that divided the aisles and the nave with a kind of red damask, up to 30 feet high. His lordship, the bishop, had called in 4 decorators by mail coach from Paris, but these gentlemen could not do everything, and far from lessening their bis otine colleagues' clumsiness by encouragement, they redoubled it by laughing at them. Julian saw that he must get up on a ladder himself. His agility served him well. He put himself in charge of the local decorators. Abe Chas was delighted to see him flying from ladder to ladder. When all the pillars had been draped with damask, there arose the problem of setting 5 enormous bunches of plumes on the great baldaquin over the middle of the high altar. A richly gilded wooden crown is supported by 8 great spiraling columns of Italian marble, but to reach the centre of the baldaquin right above the tabernacle, it is necessary... Why are we in present tense currently? It is necessary to step along an ancient wooden frame 40 feet from the ground and possibly worm-eaten. The prospect of this difficult climb had quite dispelled the gaiety of the Parisian decorators, so brilliant until then. They appeared at it from down below, talking about it a great deal, but not going up. Julian grabbed the bunches of plumes and climbed the ladder at a run. He stuck them very handsomely on the ornamental crown right at the center of the baldaquin. As he descended the ladder, Abe Chasbernard clasped him in his arms. "Epitome," cried the good priest. "I'll tell Monseigneur of this." The meal at 10 o'clock was very jolly. Never had Abe Chas seen his church so lovely. "My dear disciple," said he to Julian, "my mother used to hire out the chairs for this venerable basilica, so that in a way I was brought up in this great building. Robespierre's terror ruined us, but at 8 years old as I was then, I was already serving at masses in secret, and was given meals on the days of the mass. Nobody could fold a chasuble better than I. Never did the lace get damaged. Since Napoleon restored religious observances, I've had the good fortune to regulate everything in this venerable metropolitan church. 5 times a year my eyes had beheld it dressed up in these beautiful decorations, but never has it appeared so resplendent. Never have the damasks been so well put up, so tight against the pillars as today." At last he was going to tell me his secret, thought Julian. He's talking about himself now. He's becoming expansive. Yet this man is so evidently elated. Let fall nothing is indiscreet. "And this when he's worked so much at that and is happy," said Julian to himself. "And the good wine hasn't been stinted either. What a man. What a fine example to me. He takes the biscuit which was a piece of slang he had got from the old surgeon. When the Sanctus of the High Mass rang out, Julian made as though to take a surplice to follow the bishop in the grand procession. "What about the thieves, my dear boy, the thieves?" cried Abe Chaz. "You're not thinking about them. The procession will go, the church will be deserted, and we'll keep watch, and you and I will count ourselves pretty lucky if we lose only an ell or two of the lace around the bottom of the pillars. Yet that's yet another gift from Madame de Rubempre. It came down from the celebrated Count, her great-grandfather. It's pure gold, my dear friend," added the priest, whispering in his ear with obvious exultation. "Nothing false about it. I charge you to keep guard on the northern aisle. Don't leave it. I myself will take care of the southern aisle and the nave. Pay attention to the confessionals. It's there that the thieves' female accomplices wait for the moment we turn our backs." As he finished speaking, the quarter before 12 sounded, and immediately the great bell made itself heard. It rang out a full peal. It rang out a full peal. The richness and solemnity of its tone moved Julian, his imagination stirred from its earthly bounds. His exultation was enhanced by the odors of incense and rose petals strewn in front of the Holy Sacrament by little children arrayed as Saint John. The solemn sounds of this bell should really have awoken in Julian thoughts of nothing but the hours of 20 men paid at 50 centimes, assisted perhaps by 15 or so of the faithful. He should have considered the wear on the ropes and on the wooden frames, or the danger to the bell itself, which crashed down every second century, and have calculated ways to reducing the pay of the ringers, or of paying them by some indulgence or other benefit deriving from the riches of the church, but not diminishing its purse. Instead of entertaining such prudent thoughts, Julian's soul, lifted high by those full-bodied and masculine sounds, wandered into realms of the imagination. He will never make a good priest or a great administrator. Spirits stirred in this way are at best fit to produce an artist. Here Julian's presumptuousness is revealed in the full light of day. 50 or so of his colleagues in the seminary, having been alerted to the hard realities of the world by public hatred and in the Jacobinism they had been shown was lurking in ambush behind every hedge, would have thought of nothing except the wages of the ringers. When they heard the great cathedral bell, they would have calculated with the genius of Barim whether or not the degree of feeling stirred in the public was worth the money paid for ringing it. And if Julian had become concerned with the material welfare of the cathedral, his imagination overshooting the goal would have worked out how to save 40 francs on building while missing the chance to avoid the expenditure of 25 centimes. While in the loveliest weather in the world, the procession moved gently through Besançon, pausing at the shining altars of repose. The local authorities had vied with one or another to erect. The church remained in deep silence. Half-light and agreeable freshness reigned there. A scent of flowers and incense embalmed it still. Silence, profound solitude, the freshness of these long naves made Julian's reverie the sweeter. He had no fear of being disturbed by the Abe Chaz, who was busy in another part of the church, while his mortal frame paced slowly down the northern aisle. Confided to this charge, his soul had almost flown. His tranquility was the more complete for having assured himself that there was only a scattering of pious women in the confessionals his eye looked on without seeing. Nevertheless, this abstraction was half penetrated by the sight of two very well-known dressed women on their knees, one in the confessional, the other very near her on the chair. He looked without seeing, but whether from a vague feeling for his duties or from the administration for the lady's noble and simple attire, he noted that there was no priest in the confessional. "It's odd," thought he, "that these beautiful women aren't on their knees in front of some altar of repose. If they're devout, or if they're from society, seated in some advantageous position in the front row of the balcony, how well made that dress is, what grace." He slackened his pace in order to observe. On hearing the sound of Julian's step in the depth of the great silence, the lady on her knees in the confessional turned her head a little. Suddenly she gave a little cry and started to faint. Her strength failing, she slumped backwards from her knees. She fainted. A friend close by threw herself forward to help. At that same moment, Julian was able to see the falling lady's shoulders. A twisted collar of large natural pearls caught his eyes. What sensational flooded through him is the recognition of Madame de Renal's hair. It was Madame de Renal. I didn't know that 5 minutes ago. For it was her. The woman trying to hold up her head and prevent her from falling right down was Madame de Ville. Julian, beside himself, dashed forward. Madame de Renal's fall might have dragged her friend down had not Julian supported them both. He saw Madame de Renal's face ashen and absolutely bereft of emotion, drooping on her shoulder. He helped Madame Derville lift this charming head onto a straw chair for support. He was on his knees. Madame Derville turned and recognized him. "Be gone, monsieur, be gone," she said in a voice full of intense anger. It's vital she doesn't see you again. Indeed, the sight of you would fill her with horror. She was so happy without you. Your behavior is atrocious. Get away. If you have any shame left in you, leave at once." This speech was made with such authority that Julian felt so feeble at that moment that he took himself off. "She has always hated me," he said to himself, thinking of Madame Derville. At the same time, the nasal chant of the leading priests in the procession echoed through the church. It was coming back in. The Abbé Chastenard called out to Julian, who did not hear him at first, several times. Eventually, he arrived at the pillar behind which Julian, half dead, had taken refuge and taken him by the arm. He wanted to present him to the bishop. "So you find yourself unwell, my child," said the Abbé, seeing him so wan, and almost unable to speak. "You've worked too hard." The Abbé gave him his arm. "Come, sit down on this little sacristan's bench behind me. I'll conceal you." By then, they were at the side of the great doors. "Calm yourself. We've got a good 20 minutes before Monseigneur appears. Try to compose yourself. When he passes by, I'll lift you up, for I am good and strong in spite of my age." But when the bishop went by, Julian was trembling so much that Abbé Chas gave up the idea of presenting him. "Now, don't be cast down," he said to him. "I'll find another opportunity." That evening, he had 10 pounds of candles taken to the seminary chapel, saved, he said, by Julian's exertions and the speed with which he had extinguished them. Nothing could be less true. The poor boy was himself quite extinguished. He had not had a coherent thought since seeing Madame de Renal. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. Massive surprise. Madame de Renal's there. Whoa. I was wondering, it's either a guest author has popped in to write this chapter today, or he's just in a mood to drag something out. Why did that go for 6 pages of describing decorating a church? Legit. And now it's just okay. There's a twist coming. There's a surprise. He's slowing the pace down so excruciatingly so that to try to give impact to a surprise. I thought it was either going to be Madame de Renal or the girl from the cafe or something else, kind of in your face. But, oh, God, that was easily the worst chapter so far of this book. I wonder if you agree. Have your say over at the Hemingway List subreddit. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.